At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Religion. I'm Marshall Poe. As you may know, if you listen to New Books in Religion, I am, in fact, not the host of the channel. I am the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I really wanted to read the book that we're going to be talking about today, so I'm poaching New Books in Religion's territory, and I'm serving as a kind of guest host on the channel. The book that I really wanted to read is by Joshua Dubler, and it's called Down in the Chapel, Religious Life in an American Prison. And it's a really interesting book. It's interesting as a piece of scholarship because it's really, well, I don't know if I should say this. I don't know if I can say this. It's like no other piece of scholarship I think I've ever read. Joshua happily puts himself right in the story, and that makes it really fascinating and interesting. And he also tells us a lot about religion in American prisons, which is something that you sort of see on TV and hear about on the radio and so on and so forth. But this is what we would call the straight dope about what goes on. And so the first thing I want to do is thank Joshua for writing the book and welcome him to the show. So welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Could you kick the interview off by telling us a little bit about yourself, Joshua?
Yeah, I'm an assistant professor at the University of Rochester. I did this work when I was getting my graduate degree in religion at Princeton. I'm from New York City, and I assume, given the way that I impose myself on the narrative, more of my background will come up over the course of the next hour.
Yeah, no, that's right. You make a very good point there, because you bring things to the table. And the thing about it, the interesting about the book is that every scholar brings things to the table. It's just you're honest about it.
I do. One of the animating impulses behind the experimental form, and there are a great number of them, but one of the animating impulses is, I don't think the book is reinventing the wheel. I think it's positioned in a rather rich tradition of experimental ethnography. But one of the things that I'm trying to do is to break down the kind of unthought way that writing a book necessarily divides the world into those who write and those who are written about. So bringing myself into the frame in some way, I was hoping that would have a leveling effect.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you did. One of the purposes of the New Books Network, we deal with new books mostly by scholars, is to demonstrate to people who don't write books that these artifacts do not fall from the sky, that they are parts of people's lives. And in this case, it was really a big part of your life. It kind of took over your life. So that's really terrific for us because it does, the book is about your experience and full stop. And that's a really great thing. I think it tells people a lot about the way these books come about.
Yeah. And not to skip to the end, but, one of the animating, I guess tensions in the book is I'm in fact a practicing a Jew somewhat, but I would think of myself as epistemically and deep down a secularist, and I'm in dialogue with men who have very fierce religious commitments. So, making sense of my way of being in the world to them and their way of being in the world to me is really, I think, some of what makes the book very interesting. So this is apropos of you saying that in some way the book took over my life. So one of the ways that I make sense of what we have in common, these men as religious men, me as a secularist, is via Alain Badiou's notion of fidelity to the event. So definitely a man who gave himself to Christ on such and such a day tries to live in fidelity to that event and to that feeling of fervor and certitude that he had in a moment where he became someone that he wasn't before. Similarly, a man who took his shahada on such and such a day has a similar relationship to a moment in his past. And as I allude to toward the end of the book, you know, this book, the time that I spent doing this field work has such a structural relationship to who I am. And needs to. You know, this is a book that comes from a kind of political imperative, and it's the kind of book the justifiability or the success of this book to some significant degree will be determined by do I live the rest of my life in fidelity to what I learned and the men that I got to know, and do I embrace those obligations? So this is just apropos of the book having taken over my life.
Yeah.
I embrace that.
Yeah. I mean, I like what you say, and it kind of parallels my own experience about, I do practice a faith, I guess I would say, but I am surrounded by people, especially in the academy, who do not and are much more secular than I am. And I'm quite secular. The people that I practice this faith with, though, have a very fervent belief in God. I mean, like in the big G sense.
Yeah.
And I deal with them a lot, and it's been kind of transformational for me to try to be with them and for them to try to be with me, I imagine.
Right.
So, and this is something I think about quite a bit. So let me ask you one question before we talk about the book. You kind of already answered it, but why did you write this book?
Yeah. So I would say, like, let's deal with the two different radicals. So on the one hand, religion. It seems to me that the study of religion is populated with people with an emphatic ambivalence to the tradition of their upbringing. That seems to often be the calling, or if not an emphatic ambivalence, at least at the moment in your 20s when you're figuring out what the hell you're going to do with your life, you have an emphatic ambivalence. So that's true in my case. My ambivalence was not tortured at the moment that I chose this career, but you know, I was raised by essentially Orthodox is a slight exaggeration, but Orthodox agnostic Jews. And when I figured out that that's who I was being raised by when I was 17 or 18 years old, I got into the study of religion in college and read Durkheim and so on and so forth. And so it was kind of that was the calling to study religion. As for prisons, I was raised by leftists. I was born in 1974. So, you know, when I was 6 years old, when I was born, there would have been, 300,000 people in prison, in this country. And by the time I was, 30, there would have been, well over 2 million. Mm-hmm. So, the explosion of incarceration that is, you know, sometimes called mass incarceration in the United States, has been to me one of the, just a defining characteristic, of our age. And so I felt called to that too, from the time that I was a young person, mm-hmm. To try to engage with that, try to combat that, in some way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I very much admire you because I kind of went through a similar experience, not with prisons, but with religion, but much later in my life where I won't say I went back to the same church I was born in. I was born a Lutheran. I mean, I was raised a Lutheran. I'm not a Lutheran, mm-hmm. But now I do think about it a lot. And I mean, I do practice it and I see the value in it that I couldn't, in my Holden, Caulfield days when everybody was a faker.
In your what days?
My Holden Caulfield days, you know.
Oh, your Holden Caulfield days. Yeah.
When like everybody was a faker and it was all,
right.
It was all BS.
I would say, you know, at our best, we're fakers. I'll tell you, my life partner would wish that I would fake it a little more. I'm very comfortable with just how lazy, and abject, that I really am when I'm with her. But, you know, but when we're trying to be better people than we happen to be, whether it be professionally or whether it be ethically, we're always, faking.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of a woman named Jennifer Hart who wrote a book called Putting on Virtue that does a kind of Aristotelian spin on virtue ethics. And 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 that's her point. You know, it's like, yeah, we're, of course we're faking.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is funny, you know, because, I mean, you're alluding to, you know, one of the themes in the book, because, you know, we do, one of the knee-jerk assumptions that I assume that some readers will bring to the book is that the men in the book are fakers, right? Because of the way that we conceptualize religion as this kind of relationship to one's ultimate concern, right, and the way that we conceptualize prisoners as, you know, defined by their crime, so this person is just a rapist or a murderer, then we assume that when a prisoner professes a religious faith that he or she is just faking it.
Right. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that, because more broadly, and this was true in my own life, I'll just speak from my personal experience, for many years I just thought to myself about religious people, they can't really believe that. I mean, come on. Nobody, right, no rational person could really believe that.
Right.
Which is just silly. I mean, I look back on it and I mean, I was just not only incredibly arrogant, but kind of dumb.
Yeah. You know, I have to assume as a starting point that people believe what they say.
Yeah.
I mean, I think
it took me a long time to get to that.
You know, Charles Taylor's notion of the immanent frame, like, does kind of assume that there's something about modernity, that if you have that kind of faith commitment, then you are in some kind of sense always already opting in. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't come kind of naturally and unthought. I don't know. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I mean, I think that at a place like Greaterford Prison, and I would say that Greaterford Prison in this regard is just a place in America, people generally assume that, you know, as they would say, God is who he said he was.
Yeah.
You know, whether that be through a Christian or a Muslim framework, the assumption that there is a God roughly like the one that we encounter through the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament and the Quran, and that he made the world in some, you know, in some relationship to us humans and in relationship to me as an individual, that's like that idea comes naturally to many of our countrymen.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It was really only after I got into academia that I started not to think, I mean, I really didn't think like that anymore. I was taught not to think like that. And I'm not saying academia is a bad place or that it secularizes you or whatever, but it was a learned behavior and it was a learned reaction on my part. And it took me a long time to wrap my mind around the fact that most people weren't like me, even though, you know, I was like from the Midwest and I grew up in a humble background and church going people and, you know, but still and there was an arrogance involved in it, I have to say. But anyway, that's good. Enough about me.
Well, about arrogance, but, you know, but we're all provincial in our own way, you know, and that's some of the joys of doing ethnography, is that your own provinciality is thrown into stark relief, and sometimes in dialogue with people that you're writing about, and you know, you enable a certain kind of critical reflection on their ways of being in the world, and that, you know, those are you know, coming out of a tradition going back to Plato, you know, those moments are, you know, some of the best moments that the world has to offer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah. I was just teaching Plato. You mentioned it. How did you end up in a Greaterford prison? Why there?
Greaterford prison. I mean, I think, because they would let me in is the simple answer. I mean, I was doing my degree at Princeton at the time, and you know, you do ethnography where you are. I had been doing volunteer work in the New Jersey system, and I had gotten permission to do this project at Rahway. Right. And then the permission was revoked for reasons that were never made exactly clear, but basically New Jersey at the time had no human subjects review board at all. It was totally ad hoc.
Really?
And they had a secretary of corrections who seemed to have his heart in the right place. Anyway, so he suspended it before I began, and then so I looked to neighboring states. Pennsylvania's system, in part because the Philadelphia Society for the Alleviation of Public Miseries, the group that in some way designed the prototype of the penitentiary back in the 1780s, 90s, they became the Pennsylvania Prison Society, and they're a kind of insider watchdog group, and they are allowed access to everywhere in the system. So as the system has developed over the past 200 plus years, it's just a system that, a state system that's relatively porous. It's easier to get into a Pennsylvania prison than it is to other prisons. Mm-hmm. And Graterford is the, I call it the cultural flagship of the Pennsylvania state system. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, it's 30 miles outside of Philadelphia. It's a prison that in many ways, is Philadelphia soil, both because of, you know, the people who work there, the people who are incarcerated there, the volunteers who come in to do programming. You know, it's a downstate facility. It's a relatively vibrant place. A lot of people come and go, not like it used to be. And perhaps we'll talk about the kind of administrative shift that happened in the 90s, where, you know, a sort of culture of control such as it is was instituted, but it still is a place with a fair amount going on. So when I petitioned the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, it seemed to them like the obvious place to do the project.
Mm-hmm. And what did they do with you? I mean, how did they let you in the prison? And, you know, what kind of access did you have?
Startlingly unfettered access, at least in theory. So I had asked them only for access to the chapel because my requests, I thought that a prison administrator would regard it as frivolous. And they came back and essentially, you know, said that I could go wherever I wanted. I mean, it's a, Graterford is an old prison. It's not, you know, I think that this will vary prison to prison, state to state, but certainly the new prisons that have been built in the last 20 years that are built to be much more controlling, I assume that, you know, one of these prisons has, your movement, from my experience, is much more regimented. At a place like Graterford, like, once you're there, you kind of blend in, and you, it's not hard to move around. I mean, you have the right to move around. As a volunteer, you need to be escorted, but if you're an employee, you can, I was officially an intern, you can go where you want. It so happened, though, that I assimilated certain kinds of mores from the chaplains. So while I had the right to go wherever I wanted, the chaplains, as a general rule, don't go to the cell blocks unless they have a particular business there. I think that has to do with a certain kind of the discomfort of the experience, a desire to maintain their relationships with their parishioners, and especially with the men who work in the chapel, to kind of deal with them as colleagues and not necessarily as men who are locked behind bars where you see everything that they have in the world. So the chaplains have that kind of unwritten understanding of how they move in the prison. And I followed their lead on that, for better or for worse. I had wanted to go to the cell block where the parole violators live to see their Bible study. And I asked a few times and I was always kind of brushed off. So anyway, I ended up assimilating that. There were definitely prisoners who said that I was making a mistake in doing so because, you know, it's really on the cell blocks where the story of the prison takes place. But I tend to embrace arbitrary boundaries in terms of research and also especially in terms of writing. So that was the choice that I made in the field.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of rights do prisoners have in such a prison to religious practice?
A great many rights, I mean, relative to the other rights that they enjoy. So, I mean, I think the way to think about it is, you know, we think of the First Amendment right to free religious exercise as a founding principle, and it is. But it's only in the 20th century that comes to be interpreted. And prisoners, the front of prisoners' rights was a key front in that struggle. So you had a bunch of Supreme Court cases in the 1960s brought by people who didn't want to go fight in Korea, even though they were Buddhist or secular humanists, and the law at that time was that you had to affirm belief in a creator God. So that expanded the notion of what counted as religion under the First Amendment. But then you had in the 60s and 70s, you had prisoners suing the state in order to have the right to practice religions that up to that point weren't recognized. The most notable being members of the Nation of Islam making mm-hmm. space for Islam in the prisons. And so anyway, that expansion was pretty radical. And the principle of equal protection, even if the court has kind of gotten out of the regulating religion business somewhat, the principle of equal protection applies. So you have, one of the kind of opening gambits of the book is that I say how I said to my advisor after a number of months at the prison that the chapel at Greaterford Prison is the most religiously diverse sliver of real estate in the history of the world, right? Because you have this 2-3 acre plot of land in which 12 religious denominations share space, and that's all that infrastructure is now embedded in the law and in the administration. So the expansions that took place in prisoners' religious life in the 60s and 70s were paralleled by expansions in counseling opportunities, educational opportunities, things of that sort. Now the shift to the era of carceral control that's accompanied the rise of mass incarceration, has led to radical restrictions on those other things. Most notably in the 90s, where prisoners were declared no longer eligible for Pell Grants, so as to pursue college mm-hmm. educations. So that stuff was taken away in the current era, but you can't take away religious rights. So prisoners, they have the right to go down to the chapel. It's a right that is that in some way belongs to an older era because it can't be taken away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, and though your book is an ethnography, I hate to ask these sort of statistical questions, but I'm just interested. What percentage of prisoners at Greaterford or broadly sort of participate in the religious life of the chapel in a prison?
Yeah, it's a guess. But, from kind of tallying it up, so Greaterford has maybe 3,500 men. And I would say that in an average month, somewhere like a third of the men in the jail will come down to the chapel. Now, that doesn't give you an exact answer to your question because, American religionists are famously individualist and anti-institutional.
Yeah.
So certainly among the Muslims and as well, among the Christians, those are the dominant groups, you have people who have faith commitments and who engage in practices, religious practices, but who don't come down to the chapel mm-hmm. for one reason or another. But I estimate it as just from counting up the numbers as a third. In Ramadan, I would assume that number is higher.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see. So tell us a little bit about the chaplaincy there. Who are the people who serve as chaplains? How many are there, and can you just introduce us to them?
Yeah, there are five at the time that the book takes place. The head chaplain is a liberal Lutheran jazz musician.
Is there any other kind, really?
It's funny. I guess he is a stereotype, but he's a new stereotype to me. But he's a pluralist and a liberal. He actually got a PhD in Hebrew Bible at Drop, which is a Jewish seminary. The agencies which account for the range of religious practices at Greaterford are many. The chaplains, all of the prisoners, the administrators. But he I think, exerts a rather influential role. He's called Reverend Baumgartner in the book because he is a liberal pluralist who is very committed to the idea that there is not one way to get with your God, mm-hmm. That there are any number of ways, and that his job is to try to enable the structure by which people can get can practice their religion authentically. He uses the word authentic a lot, according to their own faith tradition. So there's Baumgartner. There are two African chaplains, Keita, who is a Methodist from Sierra Leone, and the Imam, who is from Nigeria. Then there is a Catholic priest from Pennsylvania, and then there is a rabbi who comes in a couple times a week.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And do these fellows get along?
Do they all get along?
Yeah.
Yeah, they. I mean, so the one potential outlier is the Catholic priest who is much more on the conservative end of the political spectrum, and so would sometimes squabble with the other chaplains. But no, they had a very good working relationship, and so that's where toward the end of my field work, I was talking to one of the characters in the book, and I said, I gotta move on. And they said, why? And I said, well, I have no function here. And he said, yeah, you and 85% of our staff. one of the ways I like to frame the chapel at Greaterford is that it is, one of these post-industrial workplaces like you see in the office or Parks and Recreation. It's a workplace where nothing is produced. So I don't want to overly romanticize the chaplains. Like, there is a kind of grinding, deadening. These are idealistic men. They care. They mean well. But there is a grinding, deadening quality to life at this job. And day in, day out, most everybody are just trying to get through the day and get home.
Yeah, yeah. No, I can imagine that. It comes out in the book as well. So tell us a little bit about. Let's introduce the cast of characters. You meet a lot of people, obviously, in the book. Four of them are central. So could you introduce us to them?
Yeah.
In any order, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, you're right. So this is Baraka, Teddy, Al, and Saeed.
Yeah.
Who are set up as the central characters.
Uh-huh.
They are all they are drawn from the ranks of the chapel workers. So in addition to the chapel regulars who come down and lead and participate in the 50 or so worship services, textual studies, and musical group rehearsals that constitute the weekly chapel schedule, you have 15 men who work in the chapel as clerks and janitors, labor for which they're compensated between 19 and 41 cents an hour. Save one, all of the chapel workers are serving the sentence of life without the possibility of parole for homicide. Pennsylvania is a state where life makes you parole ineligible. And whereas up through the 90s, there was a fairly robust commutation system with the tough on crime policies that really took over nationwide, but were imposed in Pennsylvania by Governor Tom Ridge, who would go on to be Bush's first director of Homeland Security, they got rid of commutation. Mm-hmm. So you're dealing with men who've been in prison for a very, very long time. All the chapel workers, as I came to discover, are also from South Philadelphia, and there are ways that religious fault lines recapitulate certain kinds of other sociological fault lines.
Mm-hmm.
Something that men say, I think this is a slight exaggeration, but there's some measure of truth to it, is that if I didn't know somebody on the outside, I'm not going to get to know him here. So intimacies in the prison carry over certain kinds of boundaries from the outside. So Baraka has been in prison as long as I've been alive. I was born in 1974. He's really, I'd say, the central character of the book, and I refer to him as an informal dissertation advisor because he takes me under wing and is very interested in telling me how things are, and sometimes, and in drilling me, and in sometimes in erecting obstacles. He's a very special individual, and he and I have a very rich relationship. So he is from South Philly, serving life and came up in the Nation of Islam cadre, which they convert en masse to Sunni Islam upon Elijah Muhammad's death in 1975. But he retains that ethos. He is politically minded, sociologically minded. Thinks that what really matters is economics, and that religion is provides a set of tools for individual and group uplift. And that was the dominant ethos in the 1970s and 80s. To see religious practice in those terms now is to make you something of a dinosaur. So that's Baraka. Al is Baraka's, they're friends from the outside. They ran with the same crew. Al used to also be in the Nation of Islam, although one day on his way to hurt someone, God struck him dead. And you know about Al's past excesses because he's now a Bible believing Christian, and so one of his central practices is to deliver testimony to to God's power, and part of that is talking about how God was looking out for you even back when you were just an awful person. Mm-hmm. This in the kind of Augustinian tradition, right. Yeah. Of talking about your past sins. So that's Al. He is moody. He's a big, heavy man, super moody, and his presence, his mood really shapes a room. He's also a musician, so he is off and on the head of the Sunday choir, and he has his own gospel group. There are five gospel groups that trade off performing in the Sunday Protestant service. Al becomes very interested over the course of my field work in saving my soul. Mm-hmm. And so he and I end up having very interesting arguments about what it is that we believe in and why and how it is that we will defend ourselves come the end of days if we're forced to. Mm-hmm. Teddy is, so Al and Baraka are both in their 50s. Teddy is maybe a decade their junior, also serving life, also a Christian. Also, he is the Al and Baraka are in some sense finished products. They are self-controlled in the way that when you've been in a prison for a very, very long time, you are able to control yourself. Because if you can't control yourself, you will get hurt during the day, or you will end up in the hole because you'll react to some kind of humiliation or to some kind of threat. And you also, if you can't control yourself at night, then you will succumb to all sorts of despair. Teddy is younger and not all the way where they are yet, and he struggles a lot. He struggles a lot because he still has a lot of hope that he's going to get out of prison, and like everybody else there, he's working on his case to some degree, and that that's means like investing a lot of hope in some very far-fetched scenarios. He is incredibly funny, really human. He is to me the most human element in the chapel, because he hurts and he's so the men take seriously this. Nobody likes a downer. There's one of the chapel workers who likes to meditate about how god awful everything is, and nobody wants to be around that. Because it's too easy to become depressed. And so Teddy is generally quite positive, but when he's struggling, you can really tell he's struggling. And then there's Saeed, who is Teddy's childhood friend. There are actually four of them, three of them central characters, who grew up in the same block in South Philadelphia, wow. All serving life without the possibility of parole. So, for people who want to see these crimes as in some sense the sui generis actions of bad men, clearly the crime happens somewhere in the middle of the story. These four boys, and three of them featured all, they're not boys anymore, but they were boys. They grew up together and they all were thrown into circumstances that led to terrible choices that destroyed other people's lives and destroyed their own lives. Mm-hmm. So Saeed is friends with Teddy, and he is a Muslim. He is a Salafi Muslim, and Salafism is the dominant religious mode in the city of Philadelphia now. It is a practical perfectionism, a sort of post-secular approach. This is Salafism is the kind of global flagship of the thing that's often called Wahhabism. So it's about, you want to live your life just as the prophets did. That was heretical. Just as the Prophet Muhammad and the pious predecessors did. In some way, all Sunnis aspire to that. Salafis really take it to an extreme. So they become this, you know, very personal purity practices take on a special importance in the performance of self and in the designation of people who are doing Islam the wrong way. Also of interest is that the particular strain of Salafism that dominates in Philadelphia is avowedly apolitical. And I think it's because of a particular history in the Middle East. This failed coup at the Grand Mosque in 1979, that this Medkhali strain of Salafism swears off politics. But then also, you could see why a traditionalist African-American Muslim in the city of Philadelphia after 9/11 would want to be very clear to certain kinds of state authorities that they're not about, engaging in politics. And then, but that works well with these men because they also are adamant in showing the sect that used to belong to the Nation of Islam that they are true Muslims and they're not merely just doing politics in the name of religion. Mm-hmm. Saeed is very serious and doctrinaire, but also rather hilarious. He's like many of these men, his background is unschooled, but he is an intellectual now. People who serve life in prison, like graduate students and like not that many other sectors of our society, have a lot of time to work on intellectual matters if they feel so inclined. And Saeed is very serious about studying Arabic. He takes the Arabic class of another prisoner once a week, and he is avid. He's a student in Villanova University, has a Bachelor of Arts program, and he's a student in that. Uh-huh. And so that's Saeed. And then the week that I selected, this is the book which begins Monday and concludes on Sunday, and then actual week, the week being in January 2006, which I selected in order for it to be a quote-unquote normal week. I didn't want it to be during Ramadan or Christmas season. I wanted something that was just normal and boring in the way that life in prison is regimented and normal and boring and repetitive. But it so happens that something happened during the week, something that was exceptional but also generic to their lives there. And what that something was is that on Tuesday, Saeed is picked up on suspicion of something or other and is kept first in custody in his cell, and then he's moved to the hole. And that's the last I've ever seen Saeed.
Really? So, yeah, right, yeah. So, yeah, yeah, you mentioned that the book does go through 7 days that you hoped were typical but weren't typical, it turned out. But I don't know, maybe it is pretty typical that someone disappears in prison.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And it's also the case that, you know, this is informs the one of the things that informs the choice of the form and the choice of the method is, you know, a faith in describing particularities that, you know, all generic things, if you pay close enough attention, turn out to be exceptional.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why you end up, you know, that's why you read literature.
Sure.
And sometimes that's what the mode of, you know, academic form where you're making an argument and you're selecting the evidence that fits your argument sometimes ends up washing away some of that that diversity and plurality, mm-hmm. And idiosyncrasy, and the form of the book that you know I've chosen is to really dial up those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's tell the story then. A typical day is Monday. What happens on Monday?
Monday is atypical, only in that there are no activities on the schedule, right? So, the chapel schedule, there are let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 formal spaces in the chapel where activities take place. There's the main chapel, there's the annex, which was built onto the chapel after 1995 when this new regime of cultural control was instituted. Prior to 95, the various Muslim groups all had their own mosques in the basement under the chapel. That was shut down after 95, and then they built this big cinder block annex. So you have the main chapel, the annex, and then two classrooms, and then something that's called the conference room where the musical groups rehearse. There are three activity blocks every day, 8 in the morning to 11 in the morning, 1 in the afternoon to 3:30 in the afternoon, and 6 in the evening to 8:30 in the evening. And every day, except for Monday, you have this slate of worship services, Bible studies, musical group rehearsals. Monday the chapel's closed. So Monday is just the chapel workers and the imam and Reverend Baumgartner who are there, and you know, and the correctional officer who's on during the day, and Monday, you know, people sit around. And,
right, but don't you, I mean, aren't there? I mean, how do I put this and not reveal my total ignorance of many things? Aren't there some religions in which you have to do stuff every day?
That's not ignorant at all, okay. Right? You know? Right. I mean, so this is right. So, you know, back, yeah, you do, but when you're in prison, you don't get to do it every day. And this allows me to provide a better answer to a question you asked earlier. So, you know, back in the day, in this period before 1995, where the Muslims had their spaces downstairs, they were able to make corporate prayer for three of the five daily prayers, and they could stay down there, and they could be. So there are five at Greater Ford. There are five daily counts where the prisoners are all counted. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, you have to be in your cell to be counted. Back in the older days, you could be out in an activity. So it used to be that the Muslims could make prayer. As they say, you know, three times a day. Now the Muslims are allowed; they can make always. They can do Juma on Friday, and you know, depending on where you are in the calendar year and what time exactly prayer happens, the chapel workers and other Muslims that might happen to be around can make prayer together at odd times. But no, they get one corporate prayer a week, and that's where the mandate to equal protection does have a way of leveling things down to a more kind of normative Protestant and especially liberal Protestant way of doing religion, right? In which, like, I mean, what you have to go to mosque more than once a week,
right?
So I mean, that is, you know, throughout this, the kind of the very, very real religious diversity that you see in the chapel is regulated by Protestant norms, you know, the Protestant norms that are imposed with a hammer.
Yeah.
So
I don't know if there's a name for that, but it should be called the Hanukkah effect. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The way that things drift. Yeah, absolutely. Right. But the way that these things work is that they work dialectically, right? So you have, it's the very Hanukkah effect of liberal Protestantism that also informs the you know, what would be called the backlash, and the, you know, which is the production of things like Protestant fundamentalism and Salafism that precisely reject that kind of mealy-mouthed, this religion that's supposed to have this very nice little niche within the kind of secular order, right? That's dialectical. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that very the drift toward one necessitates in some way the development of the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's move on to Tuesday then. Tell us what happened Tuesday.
So Tuesday you have this slate of activities, and so you know the morning begins with the Episcopal group praying and the parole violators having their Bible study, and in the afternoon you have Muslims coming down to study, although only a few of them. In the evening you have the Jews having a study session, and you have a group called Yoke Fellows having a Christian fellowship. And so I drift in and out of those activities, and, you know, and, but I also spend, intimate time with this kind of growing cast of 10 or so, of the chapel workers that are really featured. But it's also on Tuesday where you have this real event, and that's where suddenly this guy, his name is in the book, he's called Jibril, and he comes down. He's a real character because he used to box, and there used to be a traveling boxing team in the prison. This is back in like a much older era, and he's kind of a celebrity. He carries himself with a real air. He's really stylish. He's a Salafi Muslim with the kind of beard that he pulls. Some of the Salafi, you know, the Salafi mark themselves by wearing their pants high and honoring a hadith that says that you can't let your pants drag in the hellfire. And they some of them pull their beards to a point. Anyway, so he comes and he carries himself with a celebrity air because he taught Bernard Hopkins how to fight. Mm-hmm. Bernard Hopkins, now no longer, but for about a decade, was the middleweight champion of the world, who learned how to fight at Greaterford Prison. Anyway, so he shows up in the chapel and he's looking for information about Saeed, and that's where everybody, that's where you find out that that Saeed has been picked up on suspicion of something or other. Mm-hmm. And it kind of shatters the numb routine,
right,
with this kind of air of palpable excitement and right. concern.
Right. So the waters are disturbed, and what happens?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. The waters disturbed.
Yeah.
And, you know, and really by, and it's quite, you know, everyone is very concerned for him, and it's troubling for the chaplains, because the day in day out vibe of in the chapel, not necessarily of like your random prisoner who comes down for services, but the day in day out vibe among the chaplains and the correctional officers who work in the chapel and the 15 prisoner workers, the vibe there is that of a workplace, and
yeah,
they're all,
I was gonna say,
they're all colleagues,
like that, yeah.
They're colleagues in their own their way. And like, as I said, in comparing to the office and Parks and Recreation, you know, there's a lot of joking around and playing and all that. And then when events happen where the kind of imposition of that kind of state violence, everyone is kind of thrown into their proper corner, you know, either as the free person, whose job it is to be invested in the order of custody, or a prisoner whose job it is to be kind of a suspect and to be vulnerable. So that's everyone's thrown into that. But you know, by week's end, those ripples in the pond have been stilled. It only takes a few, you know, a day or two, and everything is kind of, you know, quote unquote, back to normal. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, one of the hopes, in writing the book, is to call attention to the many modes of this quote unquote normal, and to show just how abnormal and insane that it is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's very interesting you say this. I was interviewing someone who studies German perpetrators in World War II, and he was in the military himself. And I asked him what he learned from the study, and one of the things he said is that, you know, too often when we think of groups of people, we think of them as homogeneous, when in fact it's the case that they're all individuals, and it's kind of, they relate to each other differently. And just as in life, you know, he says we sort of forget this. And you know, if you were to think of the chapel as a unit, it doesn't really make much sense, because all these people are different. And they all react differently to things. They have different relations to one another. And to understand what goes on there, you really kind of have to know them. This is what this fellow said about military units as well, that they're all personalities, yeah. You know, that they're people.
I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
No, continue.
Yeah, and that basically to understand anything that happens, in this case it was mass murder, in order to understand exactly how people reacted, you have to know their relations to other people. It just, yeah. It's incomprehensible without that knowledge. And he was able to get that in his study. And he also said when he was a tank commander in Iraq, it was the same thing. That yeah. In order to get anything done, you had to know these people.
Yeah, I mean, this is where, this is why this book takes the form more of literature than of scholarship. Yeah. And it does so for political reasons, especially when you're writing about a class that's so easily pre-known. Right, that's so easily known as, you know, because we do define prisoners generally by virtue of their crimes, you know, we know what these people are. And no, we don't, right? Because that's the fact that we're willing to reduce someone to a single action of their life, that tells us as much about us as it tells us about them, right? Mm-hmm. We're at a moment in time where that kind of brutal hermeneutic is what we do to people who are incarcerated. But, you know, that tells us about ourselves. It doesn't necessarily tell us about these people. So, you know, this is the struggle. And this is why, you know, I really have feel and called to giving an account of just the particulars of things and the texture of things. Mm-hmm. You know, you can, there is structure is real. Historical moments are real and in some way shape the range of options that we can take. And so this is a book about mass incarceration, and it is a book about American pluralism, and it is a book about neoliberalism, right? And those are as the structures that enable the range of choices, those things are very real. But on the ground, you're just dealing with a mess of personalities and circumstances and varieties. And that's really, and this book feels like there is both analytically and politically real value to getting at that texture, right? Mm-hmm. It's easy to, in some way, commitments are always to particulars. You know, it's like you can love cats, but it's your cat. Yeah. It's your cat that you love. You know, it's like this is the problem with Alyosha Karamazov, right?
Yeah.
Alyosha Karamazov, he loves all people equally. And you know what? He's like a bad Christian at the end of the day because it's too flat and it's actually dehumanizing because he doesn't actually see the other, I think Dostoevsky would say, and certainly Ivan would say.
Yeah.
And like one can have commitments to prisoners, but my relationship to the problems of mass incarceration in America, at least, my relationship have changed dramatically because I am now bound to a set of individuals,
mm-hmm.
like via relationships. And maybe there's no way to communicate that through writing, and maybe there's no way that my reader can develop those kind of relationships. But at the very least, I can model what it is to develop those kind of relationships, and the reader can think about how he or she is bound in their own lives. To people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting you say that, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to read the book, because I happen to know by another connection a lot of people that have been in prison, and not to give away the punchline, but I have seen them redeemed, and it's a miracle to me, because these were bad people, and they're really not bad people anymore. I can't figure it out exactly, but they aren't bad people anymore. But anyway, we'll come to that in a second, and let's move on through the week. What happens on Wednesday?
I mean, it's because, so time in the one hand on the book is linear, and then on the other hand, time is not linear at all. So beginning on Tuesday, as the week moves ahead, throughout there are all these wormholes where I get into other things that happen in my field work and especially in landmarks and getting to know these men. But really, beginning on Tuesday, when on Tuesday afternoon you have the session Talim, where Muslims are able to study in the chapel, and you see that there are only actually five Muslims there, even though on paper a quarter of the prison is Muslim. And the question is, why are there only five there? And to answer that question, I go back in my field work to what people have told me, but then go back to 1995 and tell the story of the raid, and the raid where this regime of carceral control was imposed. The book, among other things, tries to be genealogical. So whereas the book I felt like had to take place in the present tense, because the present tense is in some real way the only tense that is real. And if any kind of radical revolutionary change is going to take place, it always has to be in the present tense to be effective. If it remains in the future tense, it's just a kind of messianic deferral. So the book is very committed to how, the practice of things is in the present. And the very fact that it's in the present means that even things that seem to be settled, I'm about to go teach Nietzsche in half an hour, but even and especially things that present themselves as being settled are actually highly contested and therefore fragile. So, that is why the book's in the present. But meanwhile, it's so as to not reify the arbitrary contested set of contingencies that you find in the present, the book feels compelled in some way to give a historical account of how that came to be,
mm-hmm.
both in terms of the revolutions in prison administration and the major revolutionary changes in normative Muslim practice.
Right.
So on Wednesday, so this begins on Tuesday with the 90s, and on Wednesday I go back to the 70s and 80s, and on Thursday I go back to the late 60s and early 70s to show, this kind of general the split between the Nation of Islam and what would have been called Orthodox up to the present day with this kind of residual politically engaged Waratheen Muhammad faction and the dominant Salafi faction. And by Friday, I'm back in the present with that story and sort of do a kind of analysis of those groups in the present and the various things that they disagree about and how and why. And then on Saturday, I actually, in a kind of a Sabbatarian fermata in the course of the week, I go back to the very beginning of time. and I recount the beginning of time from creation or something like it through the ascendancy of mass incarceration. That happens in about 4 or 5 paragraphs. But I include that because that's in dialogue with the men of the chapel for whom the fact of creation or when creation happened and why creation happened and according to whom creation happened has such a direct bearing to how one is to live one's life. And, you know, as a secular, or I said secularist earlier, that's probably exaggeration, but as a secular, you know, I'm not, to me, who created the world or how the world came into being and why, you know, does not really matter for how I am to live my life, and how I am to live my life is itself something that you have to figure out, over the course of experience precedes essence, and so you have to figure it out, and you're constantly negotiating between competing imperatives. But anyway, so I do give that account of as far as I can tell, how is it that the world came into being, and how is it that we end up here at this moment? Mm-hmm. And by extension, look how, you know, something like mass incarceration that is so pervasive, and it's so hard to imagine our world without it. Look at how freaking new it is, and how weird it is. Oh, yeah. And, you know, historically, mm-hmm. These kinds of institutions of modernity are so new and so weird. Let's figure out a different way of going about things.
Yeah, it's interesting you put it that way, because sometimes I think, and I ask my students this sometimes, I say, you know, values change a lot, and there are things that even people that we very much admire believed that we can't believe they believed, you know, Margaret Sanger, like euthanasia or something like that. And I always ask them, like, you know, we're no different than them. And so which of the things that we believe is right is going to be wrong in 100 years?
You know, exactly. I mean, and in this respect, you know, it's like this is, Antonin Scalia, not necessarily an intellectual hero of mine, also says, you know, that values don't only evolve, they can also decay, right? And so this is where it isn't just that values change, it's that, you know, it was people fighting adamantly in the beginning of the 19th century, taking a position that was very, at the time, radical, that white people ought not own black people. Yeah. That it was the actions of men and women that made over time, in addition to, of course, structural changes, that made that position over time abhorrent.
Right.
And, a future – so it isn't – I have no faith that time or history is on our side. But a future in which we don't look back at our contemporary practices of incarcerating so many of our fellow citizens, especially in the United States, where we have, you know, we have a fifth of the world's population and 25% of its prisoners. A future where we don't look back on that with horror is a dystopia.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely. I can't forget who it was, and some listener will undoubtedly remind me. But the fellow said it was English. Who was it? But anyway, it was someone in the 19th century. I think so you would take the measure of society, look at their hospitals and prisons.
Yeah, it's
Mill or somebody,
It's actually so to understand a society and look at its prisons, it's people. I don't know where that's from, and it frustrates me. And it's quoted by one of the characters in the book, and it's actually in the Publisher's Weekly Review. He cites that, and it's generally attributed to Constance Garnett's translation of Dostoevsky's.
Wow.
I'm blanking on his prison novel.
I don't know.
Anyway,
I'm embarrassed to
But I tried to trace down the citation, and I was unable to locate it.
I'll look for you. I got good Google foo. I think I can probably find it. But the way I heard it was, look at their hospitals and prisons, not just prisons. But you know, we can't get through the week, and we're taking up a lot of your time, and you got to go teach Nietzsche. But there are a couple questions I want to ask you if you have another couple seconds.
I do, sure.
Okay, good. So one question, really there are only two questions. One question is, and I don't know if this is answerable given the individuality of the people you talk about, what does religion do for people in prison?
Yeah.
You can't just say, well, that's a ridiculous question, Marshall. You an idiot?
Look, the book has this fluid, novelistic style, but the first editor that I ended up working with, two editors at Farrar Straus, and the first editor that I worked with was, you know, demanded that I that I give account, that I give answers to questions like that. And so I do provide them in a set of what I call theses that precede the various chapters beginning on Tuesday. And it's, I provide in those passages of the book, you know, a variety of different ways to answer that question, and I'm not committed to any one, because I'm of the belief that, you know, the theoretical framework that you bring to answer that question goes a long way toward answering the question itself. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of paranoid practice theory version of that question, which is, what does religion do? It takes convicts and makes them prisoners, which is to say, a people with the know-how to survive prison. Right? That's one of the things that it does. What does it do? Well, it takes men, and this is a different answer to that question. It takes men who have struggled with impulse control and gives them the vocabulary and the practices to engage in kinds of in personal mastery where they don't just react. What does it do? It takes men who had a very brutal and individualist notion of manhood, and it transvalues manhood such that manhood isn't about defeating others. Manhood is about surrendering oneself. You know, so there's really a great number of answers to that question, mm-hmm. and I try to provide them in a book, and I provide them in a, and this is apropos of the structure of the book and of time. They're in the book in a latter temporality. They're in those are presented in the book in a, and it's years later. It's subtly done, but it's, you know, it's the first thesis introduced with the preamble. Years from now, at a critical moment in the composition of this book, I will pen 10 theses. Mm-hmm. So it's after having struggled with all this material for years and years that I come to posit certain kinds of answers to those questions, and I share them with the reader. Those kinds of clean synopses are meant to stand in tension to the flow and mess of the mm-hmm, rest of the book. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Sure, that's fair. So let me ask you another unfair question. I don't know if it's an unfair question. It'll be my final question before I ask you the final question. So I guess that would make it the penultimate question, to be fancy about it. So you mentioned your own religiosity, such as it is. How did writing this book change your own religious practice and beliefs?
It didn't. I mean, I'm a work in progress in that regard too, but it you know, it didn't. I came in as a I'm a dyed in the wool ethical Jew, you know. So even though I have a yeshivish background, from the time that I was very young, I always understood that. If there are two classes of commandments that pertain to our obligations to God and the commandments that pertain to our obligations to our fellow man and woman, I always was strongly on the side of the latter of those being the ones that matter. And that's always been true for me, whether I've been in the habit of going to synagogue or not going to synagogue. I mean, it so happens that I now have a couple of kids, a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, and the ways that we work in the early 21st century are so grueling, and especially if you're an academic, the boundaries between work and not work are so hard to erect. And so for those reasons, you know, for that reason, my wife and I, we've fought hard to institute the practice of the Sabbath, for example. In addition to that, you know, there's like going to synagogue is a solution to the weekend problem, because suddenly you have these little kids and you have no idea what to do with them. And especially if you live in Rochester, New York, you can't just take them outside. So, you know, we go to synagogue now, but those are all, you know, and this isn't remotely cynical. It's quite earnest, but you know, that's the kind of thing that's affected my relationship to my practice. The relevant practices of my time at Greaterford have to do with, a different set of concerns. And that is, okay, so, this has been a great experience. These men gave me a lot. This book is going to do things for me. It has done things for me that will allow me to have the sort of career I want. Okay, so what then am I in for now? You know, what am I in for? Right. And as far as I can tell, if I'm not in for life in some significant sense, then I'm a scoundrel. Right. So I need to be in for it for life. And what that means can change over time. But I teach in prisons. I try to organize with other kinds of activists and people who are trying to change the way that we punish. Mm-hmm. And so that's I need to be in for it in that regard.
That's a good answer. I like that answer very much. I mean, just to reflect on my experience a little bit, and I've already talked about it, when I kind of came into the church, so to say, into my spiritual community, the thing that really impressed me was the fact that the people who really had very rough backgrounds and were rough characters were really transformed by the experience. And it provided kind of a model for me, and it provided a certain amount of hope that there could be a kind of personal transformation through a certain kind of action or practice. I mean, I don't know if the prisoners felt that themselves, but I definitely.
Yes. I'm the one who's somewhat skeptical about that because I have a much more kind of fluid post-structuralist notion of the self, whereby what is it that we're reifying when we say that someone is essentially this or that? But I'm a huge outlier in that. At a Greaterford prison, that is precisely the anthropology that people have. People are essentially something, and it is precisely via that kind of experience of rupture, of taking a shahada, of giving yourself over to Christ, and then the regime of practices that such a conversion necessitates, that you do become fundamentally something else. That is the dominant anthropology, and the language of transformation is precisely the language that men, whether they be Christian or Muslim or something else, that is the language that they use.
Yeah, I'd put myself in that category. I think I'm a different person than when I came in. I did think I was one thing. And the record shows that I was.
Well, and now well, there's, you know, but there's a real ethical utility to that kind of narrative, right? Yeah. It's like to mark what I was lost and now I'm found.
Right.
To mark what you once were and to assert and to declare publicly with the community, I am not what I once was. Yeah. I am now living for something else.
Yeah,
that's an exceedingly important practice. Mm-hmm. Whether you're in some ways it's like when you have a good therapist, the good therapist helps you with that practice too.
Yeah.
And when you have a bad therapist, the bad therapist allows you to linger indefinitely in that state of being non-transformed.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So in any case, to make those kind of declarations in a community with fellowship is a central practice for self-craft, whether one is religious or secular.
That's extraordinarily well put. It's just really, really extraordinarily well put. So today we've been talking to Joshua Dubler about his book, Down in the Chapel, Religious Life in an American Prison. Joshua, I want to have one very brief question. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a couple of things. The first pertains to the being in for it, as I put it. I'm working on a book called Break Every Yoke, and that's language from Isaiah that the abolitionists used. Break Every Yoke, Religion, Power, and the End of Mass Incarceration. And that's a book that I'm writing with a guy named Vincent Lloyd, who's a philosopher at Syracuse, and Chris Garces, who's an anthropologist at Cornell. And we've been working together for a couple of years now, and we're trying to the animating kind of impulse of that book is that, from penitentiary days and certainly up through the end of the 20th century, religion has helped to American religion has helped to underwrite American mass incarceration in a number of ways, and it's going to take new kinds of conceptualizations of religion and new religious practices to end mass incarceration. So we're working on that book together. Hopefully we'll have a finished draft of that, within the calendar year. And I'm also beginning to work on, I think my next monograph that I'm going to write myself is a sort of cultural history of guilt in America, a story that takes place at the intersection of criminal justice and psychoanalysis and theology and pop culture.
Yeah, well, those sound like great, great projects. Good luck with them. And let me say to everybody again, we've been talking to Joshua Dubler about his book, Down in the Chapel, Religious Life in American Prison. I hope everybody goes out and buys it. Joshua, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so very much for having me. I've enjoyed it tremendously.
Absolutely. And let me say that I'm Marshall Poe. I'm actually the host of New Books in History, but I'm subbing on New Books in Religion because I really wanted to read Joshua's book. And let me also say thank you to everybody who listens to this podcast, and have a good week.